Good afternoon. Thomas Sotaki on behalf of Doug Farrar, Jr. Thank you for the opportunity to argue this case today. You know, our position is that this was just not the case in which Mr. Farrar, Jr. received a fair trial. As you are aware, we've raised really numerous issues on appeal, each of which have their own merit, but of course, as a whole, collectively, the cumulative effect of it is that Mr. Farrar did not have a fair trial. In terms of which issues to focus on, given our time constraints, you know, I'll just start with a couple that I think are probably on the more compelling side, and that would be first the issue of the Pinkerton instruction being given. You know, I think it's clear that that instruction should not have been given and did not apply in this case. I think that was clear at the time of the trial. But I think
it's clear that Pinkerton played no role here, but how did it make any difference? Is there any reasonable chance the jury misused it? Because in order to have used the Pinkerton theory, they first would have to find that he was a participant in the conspiracy, and if that was the charge, it doesn't seem to go anywhere. I mean, not at either. But how does it harm anything?
Sure, and I think the first thing, you know, to point out is what I'm sure everyone is aware of. Because we objected to the instruction at trial, really it's the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict. So, you know, legally it's respectfully probably a more appropriate question for the government, given that it's their burden. But however, I do have some thoughts on that, of course. You know, I think you have to look at... You can't talk about this without talking about the strength of the evidence in this case, which frankly was questionable. And so I think you start there. I mean, really, this was a case that dealt with the credibility of one witness, one cooperator, Stephen Shigemoto, who initially upon arrest said nothing about Mr. Farrar Jr. Then a couple of days later in a debrief proffered session said a little more without much details, and then decided not to cooperate for 3 or 4 years until he was a couple of years into probably a 135-month sentence he wasn't enjoying, and then he came back to cooperate. The case hinged almost entirely on his credibility. There was, of course, some effort to corroborate his testimony. But to your question, you know, with that in mind, you know, the case really came down to 4 trips to the mainland that Mr. Shigemoto admitted to going and packing drugs for. The third and fourth trip, even he admitted, you know, Doug Farrar Jr. was not there, was not involved. And it kind of gets into the other issue.
But he communicated with him during that trip.
That's what he said. You're correct. That's what he said, is that there was some nominal communication with Farrar Jr. On that trip. However, you know, we get into the to-wit language in the indictment, in which mentions the drugs, which was seized from the fourth trip that Mr. Farrar Jr. was not at. And if you put that all together, when you give the jury an instruction that says, you know, in part, if one member of the conspiracy commits a crime in furtherance of the conspiracy, the other members have also under the law committed that crime. I understand your point that the thought.
What's the other crime that they might have convicted him of under the Pinkerton instruction other than the conspiracy?
The fourth trip and the drugs from the fourth trip is what the concern would be. If a juror rationally thought, which I think they could have, given the fact that Farrar Jr. was not there, if the jurors thought that he was not involved in that fourth trip, and if the jurors thought that Mr. Shigemoto obviously was, and if the jurors thought that Mr. Shigemoto's commission of that offense made Farrar Jr. guilty of it, even though... he wasn't there, then I
but
think
they couldn't have used that Pinkerton theory without first finding that he had joined the very conspiracy charged in the indictment. Okay?
I understand your point, Your Honor. I think our point is that the language in and of itself is confusing enough where perhaps that language could have led to jurors thinking, because of the fourth trip and the involvement there, that there was a conspiracy, again, because the indictment, as it stated, to wit, focused on the drug seized in the fourth trip.
So, well, now you raise a separate issue on there, but the problem with that theory is that it says, you know, beginning, and then the beginning date is 2013, well before the fourth one. And so right. It obviously alleges a broader conspiracy over a longer period of time, and therefore all of the other things are part of that conspiracy. And so I don't see how there's any departure from the indictment in that.
Yeah, I understand, Your Honor. I think as it relates to this Pinkerton issue, though, the fact that the indictment did specify the drugs from the fourth trip, and then now you have this Pinkerton instruction that obviously in our opinion, obviously should not have been given.
Your theory is that the Pinkerton instruction allowed them to get out of the fourth trip into the first, second, or third.
I think what I'm suggesting is the Pinkerton instruction may have confused the jurors into believing that even if they thought Mr. Farrar Jr. was not involved in the fourth trip, if Mr. Shigemoto was involved in the fourth trip, then somehow they could hold Mr. Farrar Jr. Responsible for the fourth trip because of Pinkerton liability on the part of the actors.
There still have to be a conspiracy, either as to the fourth or something. There still has to be a conspiracy before they could pick up Pinkerton.
I understand your point, Your Honor. I guess our point is that the instruction obviously should not have been given, and it is ripe for confusing jurors who aren't well-versed in, this law and conspiracy law. And it adds to the confusion because the two-wit language in the indictment specifies the drugs from the fourth trip. And can we sit here and say beyond a reasonable doubt that absolutely played no role in their conviction? And I don't think we can.
Can I ask about the indictment? I mean, it seems to be a separate argument. You're trying to kind of suggest that the two-wit language could have confused the jury, but the jury's not looking back to the indictment. The jury's looking at the evidence. I mean, there may be, you have a separate argument that that evidence shouldn't have been presented given the indictment. But if we don't accept that, then I don't understand how the two-wit language helps you on the Pinkerton for jury confusion.
Right. I mean, I think the point is that when you're looking at the evidence in the case, Shigemoto's testimony was that Farrar Jr. was there on trips 1 and 2, and he was not there on trips 3 and 4. And, his testimony about Farrar Jr.'s actual whatever communication was not much. And so the concern is if you have this Pinkerton instruction, regardless of the wit language, you have drugs that were seized from the fourth trip, making it, of course, more, provable or reliable to the jury that, than the other three, is you actually have actual drugs. And you have Shigemoto involved in trip 4 and arguably Farrar Jr. not, the Pinkerton instruction could cause some confusion. And I don't think we can say beyond a reasonable doubt that it did not.
If the charge were possession or possession with intent to distribute, specifically the fourth shipment, I understand your argument. And I don't know that I can ask you to anything more, but that's not the conviction we're dealing with here. We have to go back to the conspiracy conviction.
Right.
And you don't get into triggering Pinkerton until you've gotten past the notion of a conspiracy. So I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. How is it the jury could have been confused by this to reach the conclusion there was a conspiracy, leaving aside the fourth shipment in particular? It seems to me that the instruction couldn't push the jury toward finding there's a conspiracy, because that's the first step they're required to do to trigger the Pinkerton instruction.
And I understand your point, Your Honor. I think, again, I just would submit that, we're all here today talking about this with the background we have in conspiracy law and experience with the case law and criminal defense and criminal law. And the jurors don't have that. And so, I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest that when you give an instruction that absolutely has no legal application and a layperson reads it, that someone could read that without this legal background and think that, well, if Shigemoto was involved in the fourth trip, and even though Farrar Jr. wasn't, well, maybe that means they're in a conspiracy and maybe therefore we can hold him accountable for it. So I understand your point, though, but our point is that if you look at it from the perspective of the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, that's obviously a really high standard. And I just don't think we can say that. You know, if the standard was lower, maybe, you know, I think your points obviously are valid ones. But
A while ago, I did trials, and it's sort of a three-ring circus, and you're trying to spin the plates all over the place, and you lose track. And I did not, it's been a few days, but I remember looking back at the discussion there, and I don't recall anybody saying to the district court, you know, this really doesn't belong here because the charge is conspiracy. It's not something else holding a co-conspirator responsible for a particular crime. Was that ever brought up in the discussion?
The instruction was objected to.
Instruction was objected to, but I'm not sure that, and again, I understand what goes on in a trial, but I'm not sure the district court was ever presented with the most obvious thing that seems to us on reflection to suggest, well, this really has no place here because the only charge defendant is accused of is conspiracy. Not this possession with intent to distribute itself. So just curious as to how it came about, that's all.
Understood. You know, as to some of the other issues, if it's okay to move on, you know, the restriction of cross-examination of Mr. Shigemoto, we thought was obviously problematic and error. And I go back to the strength of the evidence that I talked about earlier. You know, there's no doubt that his reliability and credibility is what mattered in this case. And factually, the way it came about, you know, to initially not say anything, to say a little at a proffer, and then to decide not to cooperate, and then later decide to cooperate, the government understood that to be a problem with his credibility and sought to cure that problem by pointing out why he chose not to cooperate, because he was afraid of being a snitch in prison. So with that being said, you know, the fact that we were trying to make, which we think is a reasonable inference that should have been allowed, is at the time when he chose not to cooperate, and he wants to say it's because he didn't want to, he thought he was going to be a snitch and receive some bad treatment in prison, an alternative explanation that's reasonable is that he really didn't have anything truthful to say about Farrar Jr. And so the 10-year mandatory minimum, why that matters, I hope it was clear in our briefing, is even with that motivation, if he, knowing he was facing a mandatory minimum of 10 years, and the only way to get below it was to cooperate, and he still chose not to cooperate with that motivation, well, it's because he didn't have anything truthful to say about Farrar Jr. I mean, that's what the argument would have been. If he knew, knowing he was facing 10 years, if he had something truthful to say, he would have said it, because he was facing 10 years. And so, I mean, I think that was...
To the cross-examination you're able to do over the fact that after he sat in prison a few years, he decides to come in and he's the whole case, and you can cross him, you know, quite effectively, that he has a very strong motive to tell a false story to get a reduced sentence. And I don't see that this really adds very much what you weren't allowed to add. And the jury didn't agree, but that's why we have trials.
Right. And you know, I would respectfully, you know, suggest when we're looking at the law when it comes to, you know, restricting that kind of cross-examination, I mean, we don't need to show it would have necessarily succeeded. We just need to show that it might reasonably have questioned the witness's reliability or credibility in light of the cross-examination, and that's the Fowler versus Sacramento case.
But you have to take into account countervailing, you know.
I guess that's the part that really kind of concerned me, Your Honor, throughout the trial. I mean, we were always focused on concerns over the prejudice to the government, and it never really flowed the other way. I mean, the exact same could be said. The jury knew he got a 135-month sentence, so why did it prejudice the government if they would have known he had a 10-year mandatory minimum? I mean, we weren't doing it because we somehow, therefore, the jury would think Mr. Farrar was going to get a 10-year man in and nullification or play a part in it. They knew he got 135 months. It goes to the human element of motivation at the time he decided not to cooperate.
And well, but if we know he got 135 months and the jury knows that, I'm not sure how it strengthens the notion of what his motivation was at the time, that there was a mandatory minimum of something different out there.
It's the dynamics of how the system works that, and I think we all know this, right? The charges he was facing, there was a mandatory minimum of 10 years and he would not be able to get below it without cooperation. That's the argument. Not that he had a long sentence and he maybe could have got less. He could not have broken 10 years without cooperating, and he chose not to. And they want to say it's because he didn't want to be a snitch. But we're saying he chose not to, even with that huge motivation of facing 10 years or more, because he didn't have anything truthful to say. And I think
I'm sure you made that argument as it was. I just don't know how the mandatory minimum affects that. You could fairly say, and obviously did say, that he was facing a substantial sentence. Look at the sentence he got. And that really comes in for when he decides to tell a story the government likes and look at the benefit he got from that. But I'm really not sure I understand how the mandatory minimum the first time around adds it to the scale.
Because it's the dynamics of human motivation. And if you know you're facing 10 years versus, hey, you might get a big sentence, you might not. I mean, that's different. And you know, the analysis here, again, is, you know, under the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, you know, full and fair cross-examination. It hinged on Shigemoto's credibility. And it was an issue of, might it reasonably cause a juror to question his reliability if we're able to get into that? And I don't see how we can say that it might not have done that. I mean, it's a valid argument. It's much more powerful than it is just to say, well, he knew he was facing time and he thought he could have got less. I mean, it's a much more powerful element because it's the reality of it. It's how the system works.
So, can I ask you a question about the 404B issues?
Sure.
I was confused. Your brief seemed to suggest that the government introduced both the methamphetamine prior and the marijuana prior. Government
says
are you contending? I mean, are they right on that?
It was the same case, right? It was the same case from 2006. And I don't want to misspeak, but if I recall correctly, you know, although there was, I think the conviction was for marijuana, is my recollection, but I could be wrong. There was evidence that the house had methamphetamine in it at the time in 2006.
Because they contend, you raise both and say that they violated, you know, 404B error on their part as to both, but then they came back and said, no, we only introduced the methamphetamine aspect. It was defense that wanted to bring in the marijuana aspect.
And that was once the courts, again, my recollection is once the court decided that she was letting it in, you know, then of course the fact that it was really primarily a marijuana case, you know, we thought would mitigate against it. You know, one last thing, and I
that would eliminate, if the government didn't bring in the marijuana aspect, then that 404B argument only goes to the methamphetamine. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Understood.
You've argued both, but I didn't see the factual basis for arguing it as to.
Understood. And again, you know, I just point out to all these cumulative issues, you know, the jury deliberated for 2.5 days. That's what we have to say. I guess if it's possible.
You want to reserve some time?
I could save a minute or two. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Purcell.
Thank you.
You've had a busy week as well.
What's that?
You've had a busy week as well.
I've had a very busy week, and I'm kind of proud to be the person who both started and ended your week of oral argument. I think that's kind of fun. I suppose I should start with the Pinkerton and perhaps the Tu-Wit clause.
Government propose the Pinkerton instruction?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why on earth did you propose such an instruction in this case? It has absolutely nothing irrelevant.
I'm with you, Your Honor. The Pinkerton instruction, we all understand now, I think, that Pinkerton goes from conspiracy to substantive act, not the other way around. And this was a conspiracy case. And so it is a little bit unusual to have asked for that instruction.
Nonsensical. It's not just unusual. It's irrational.
My understanding is that the reason that instruction was requested was precisely because the prosecutor was concerned that the defense was going to try to cut off the third and fourth trips from the first and second trips. And so
that's actually his theory of prejudice.
It is his theory of prejudice, but it's not a theory that makes sense. Because what
you thought it made enough sense that you proposed it to try and block it, and now you're saying it's not prejudicial?
Well, it's also not an argument that was made at trial. It's an argument made now. I mean, that's, you know, we don't know how things are going to play out when we're up front talking about what jury instructions we want. We don't know what arguments are going to play out. And as it turns out, the defense did not argue that only the fourth trip was charged, or that the jury should not convict because the defendant wasn't personally involved in the fourth trip. That doesn't actually come up during the trial at all. But today...
That went to the scope of the conspiracy. It still doesn't have any... Asking for a Pinkerton instruction in a conspiracy-only case is borderline frivolous. And I would just hope we wouldn't see something like this again.
I understand, Your Honor. I absolutely understand. It remains true, though, that it's really difficult to think of any way in which the inclusion of that Pinkerton instruction could have hurt anything. It's legally completely correct. And to the extent that it has any applicability here, it probably would be to ensure that the jury understands that the conspiracy is one thing in this case that covers at least the four trips. Something that
Can you point us to any other cases where a Pinkerton instruction has been used in a case where it's a conspiracy only charge and the courts addressed this issue?
No, Your Honor. And I say that with
it's that unique of a mistake that no one else has ever addressed it.
Well, there certainly have been cases, there have been many cases in which courts have confused the import of Pinkerton and have believed that Pinkerton had an application in a conspiracy case. That's a pretty basic mistake, honestly. But I don't remember one where a Pinkerton instruction was given in the context of a conspiracy case.
Well, isn't that the problem we face? Because it was given here. And Mr. Taki's argument is that the prejudice is that it might have encouraged a jury to convict on conspiracy when they might not have otherwise. And I mean, you're trying to bridge a gap here. You're trying to say, well, there was a reason why it got pushed forward, even though it shouldn't have been. But that seems to weigh against the notion that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Because, in fact, if it could have encouraged a jury to convict on conspiracy, if it could have assured them that they didn't have to limit themselves to any particular shipment, isn't that a problem?
No, Your Honor, it's really not. Because one of the things that my learned adversary ignores here is that there was a single conspiracy. And not only was there a single conspiracy among the three individuals, Farr Sr., Farr Jr., and Shigemoto, and perhaps others, not only was there a single conspiracy, but that single conspiracy clearly covered all four trips. And so it's for that reason alone, it's impossible for this instruction to have confused the jury in any way. And it's important to point out that that's how the case was tried. I went back just yesterday and reviewed the closings. And
the drug quantities for each of the trip, were they each individually sufficient to meet the statutory minimum for the enhanced sentence?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. What I'm not sure of off the top of my head is whether they would meet it for both drugs. There may have been a shipment that didn't include cocaine. I can't remember off the top of my head. Might not have met it for both drugs, but it certainly would have for methamphetamine, for any one of the four trips. Now, the fourth trip, of course, is the one where...
50 grams of methamphetamine in all four?
That is my recollection. To be honest, I probably have to go back to make absolutely sure, but that's my recollection. Because these were very, very large shipments. I mean, the fourth shipment, the one that was seized, were 32 pounds of methamphetamine, and they used the same kind of packaging. So without actually looking at the testimony, I'm pretty confident that they were very substantial, each of them. And of course, again, because that fourth shipment was actually seized, that's the one that was actually weighed and for which we had a lab report. The obvious reason why it was included in the, as it was referred to in the indictment. I think my position on the Pinkerton instruction is pretty simply that it couldn't have confused the jury. It was legally correct, and for that reason alone couldn't have confused the jury. And as one or more of your honors have already pointed out, since it assumes the existence of the conspiracy, it can't confuse, and because the only charge in the case was conspiracy, there's no reason to believe that it would have confused someone into convicting of the conspiracy, which was the prerequisite for the application of the instruction. Okay.
I want you to organize your comments on the other issues, including those raised by the defense. But at some point, I would like you to speak to one of the sentencing issues that hasn't been discussed so far, and in particular, the obstruction of justice enhancement. Because as I read the transcript, although it's pretty darn clear what it was the court was thinking, I don't actually see there a finding of fact that the court made that the defendant had testified untruthfully. The language used compares the witness's testimony, the defendant's testimony, to the verdict. The jury obviously didn't believe him, and the court moves on pretty quickly. Is it a problem if the court itself did not make a finding of fact that there had been obstruction of justice?
First of all, the court did make a finding of fact that there had been an attempt to obstruct justice by testifying falsely.
Do you know where I would find that?
Excerpts of record 1462. Is where the
Castro-Ponce requires explicit findings that not only did the defendant give false testimony, but also that the falsehoods were willful and material to the criminal charges. Where did she make those explicit findings as to those two elements? I don't see that.
Excerpts of record 1462, the district judge said first that the jury believed Mr. Shigemoto and could not possibly believe Mr. Farrar and have a conviction. And that's
that. How does that make it willful? I mean,
that's the next thing. This one covers the first two elements that the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that Farrar Jr. was lying, because they couldn't possibly have believed him and convicted. Given the nature of his testimony, they couldn't have convicted him. They must have believed beyond a reasonable doubt that his statements were false. And that same sentence underscores the materiality of that attempted obstruction.
But literally what the district court said is not even a finding that she thought that it was false and willful. All it is he took the stand, testified contrary to the allegations that were put forward by Mr. Shigemoto. The jury believed Mr. Shigemoto and could not possibly believe Mr. Farrar and have a conviction. So the testimony that was given by Mr. Farrar was an attempt to obstruct justice, and the court finds those 2 points appropriate. So you just said, well, the jury found it, and so that plugs in. That's not how I read Castro-Ponce.
Two things about that, Your Honor. One is that the objection that was raised here was to the obstruction of defense, adjustment, I'm sorry, was a flat objection. There was no detail to it whatsoever. And the district judge, literally, I object, that's it. So the district judge essentially thinks here, this is a no-brainer. The jury is found beyond a reasonable doubt that's a higher standard than what the judge herself.
Yeah, but the problem with that is there's all the time, yeah, there's a lot of times where a jury makes, a factual a decision that implies that one witness is only consistent with one witness's version of events and is inconsistent with another. That doesn't mean that in all those cases there's an obstruction of justice. And I think that's the problem here, is there's a whole bunch of intervening steps that are left out. Now, it may have been apparent at the time. It may have been clear to the district court because of how Farrar testified that, you know, he was lying. All those things may have been true, but that's not what we're seeing in the record. So that's what's troubling. How do we distinguish this, what the district court did here, from any other case where a jury makes a finding that's inconsistent with the testimony of a witness? We could have obstruction of justice charges for almost every defendant that's convicted.
And in fact, it is appropriate in not every time a defendant testifies, but in many of them, for the same reasons that it's appropriate here. But if a defendant didn't testify completely inconsistently with the verdict, that would be different, and it happened. But here, it was material because it went directly to the issue.
Okay, but I agree with everything you're potentially saying. The problem is the district court didn't make that finding.
I think
the district court didn't even make the finding.
I think she did. I think that when she commented on the jury's reaction, if she disagreed with it, she clearly would have said so. At least by implication, she is saying this is clear that he lied. It is absolutely clear that he lied. It's clear because we know that if the jury believed him, then they would have acquitted. They had to acquit, which makes it both his testimony false and material. And with respect to the third element, the willful intent, I mean, for one thing, it's hard to argue it's not willful intent when you get up and you say, I didn't do it, I wasn't there, it was a coincidence that I was on a flight twice, but shouldn't know that I'm coming back to Hawaii, et cetera, et cetera. It's hard to argue that it's not willful. So the only question here really is...
I agree with all of what you're saying. It would have been a relatively simple case to make. It wasn't made, and it wasn't on the record. And that, I mean, every argument you're making now could be made about every defendant who has a verdict against them. But a lot of them, they're giving testimony that is discounted or rejected. But, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into a jury decision. And not all of those are automatically, oh, the witness was lying. This case seems to be a strong case for that, but there wasn't a finding.
Your Honor, I really disagree with the proposition that there wasn't a finding here. What I haven't quite gotten to is the focus on the last part of that quote. The testimony that was given by Mr. Farrar was an attempt to obstruct justice. It's not fleshed out in detail, but then...
Well, it's a legal conclusion is what it is.
It's also, though, I think we need to keep in mind that the word attempt in attempt to obstruct justice, the word attempt carries with it, just as it does it for the crime of it, of attempt, it carries with it the intent, a specific intent to accomplish the result. That's willfulness. That's willful intent. So while it really consists of one word, the word attempt to obstruct justice, it's still a finding that there was willful intent.
That's how you would distinguish this case. If the district court had said he's guilty of obstructing justice, that would have been problematic. But because the district court said attempt to obstruct justice, that makes it a finding of fact that fits within our prior case.
It is a shorthand way of making a willful intent finding. That's what it is. Is there, if there aren't any other specific areas, then I probably should go back to the restriction.
I just had a quick question about an issue that hasn't come up in that. Why was Farrar Sr. asked during cross-examination why he went to trial? What was the purpose of that cross-examination? What was it trying to accomplish?
I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you, so I'm hoping I got that question right.
I'm wondering why Farrar Sr. was cross-examined as to the fact that he went to trial. Why was that a relevant fact to put in front of the jury about Farrar Sr.?
The sequence of events there was that on the first question on the first question of that series on cross-examination was whether he had pled guilty to the earlier offense. There was no objection to that question, and so it was answered in the affirmative. The prosecutor merely wanted to complete the circle with the facts that were going on there, as opposed to making any hay out of it. He just wanted to make clear that there was, because remember, at that point, the jury already knows that he did plead guilty. And so just to tie up the loose ends, what happened in the second one,
could have been asked if he had the conviction. Why was it brought up that he chose to go to trial?
I think it was just to clear it up, the fact of what happened. I don't think there was any, deep motive or ulterior motive for that. It was clear that he had pled guilty once, he had two prior convictions, he had gone to trial, and it was worded in terms of he expressed his constitutional right to go to trial, and then after that it was dropped completely. There was no further examination about it. It seems, I think it's pretty clear that when no one made any hay out of that, the fact that he went to trial, nobody accused him in closing or cross-examination or anything else of being wasting the time of the court, of lying, of any negative inference from the fact that he exercised his constitutional right to go to trial. It seems like at a minimum, there's no prejudice whatsoever to Farrar Jr. in the fact that Farrar Sr. had, as Farrar Jr. was doing at that time, exercised his constitutional right to go to trial.
Yeah, I mean, what the government said at trial is that, quote, it did not want to leave the jury with the impression that Farrar Sr. had taken responsibility for his drug trafficking when he had gone to trial.
True, but that argument wasn't actually made to the jury. The jury was merely told that he had gone to trial.
The delta between just telling the jury that he was convicted and that he went to trial to sort of catch that inference to his exercise of constitutional rights.
I can't tell you how the jury heard it, because I'm not inside their minds, but I can tell you that no argument was made to take advantage of that fact or cast aspersions on Farrar Sr. In fact, if I remember correctly, the prosecutor didn't mention Farrar Sr.'s testimony. Or if he did, it was very, very, very quick mention, and without going into any of that sort of thing. I'm almost out of time. Do any of your honors have questions about anything else?
I don't think so.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Otake. And we'll give you a little bit more time if you need it. I think you've got a minute.
Thank you. The reason why Mr. Farrar Sr. was asked that is because a prosecutor wanted to discredit him for not taking responsibility and coming to court and testifying that this actually happened, but I didn't plead to it. I fought it. And the inference was, you know, he didn't take responsibility. He fought it. And now you want to believe him. He's not believable. He should have done that. And our point was, if you're going to do that, number one, that shouldn't be allowed. But if you're going to do that, at the very least, we should be able to ask him, that's their version. Why did you go to trial? And he was going to say, because at my age, with my health, I was looking at, you know, 20, 30 years. It was a life sentence. It wouldn't have mattered much. I just figured I didn't want to die in prison. And so if they're going to discredit him by suggesting that, surely he was a critical witness to us, and he should have been allowed to explain that, and that deprived us of an opportunity to rehabilitate him. You know, on the couple of things, on the Pinkerton issue, you know, the government's comments as to why they requested it is exactly what our concern was. And it goes exactly to what we're saying. You know, in the first instance, regardless of this to wit argument that we make, which we think is valid, even if you go with the concept that it was a broader conspiracy, the Pinkerton instruction could have confused the jury in a prejudicial way. If you go even further and we're right about the to wit language of the indictment saying it was a more narrow conspiracy, what the Pinkerton instruction could have done is made the jurors think, okay, well, maybe there was, you know, two conspiracies going on, and maybe Farrar Jr. was involved in trips one and two, and not four. But if Shigemoto was involved in four, then Pinkerton says, and therefore it leads to further confusion. The jury is instructed at the beginning of the instructions that they are to apply the law as the judge gives it to them. And the inclusion of that instruction obviously was a signal to them that that's part of the law they need to apply, and therefore, you know, we can't assume that they did not consider it and it did not affect their deliberations. So, I thank you all for your time, and unless there's other questions, you know, I'll stop there and ask that you consider all of these things on their own, but also the cumulative effect of all of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both of you for your presentations in this case. The case is now submitted, and the court is adjourned.